And welcome to this audio edition of Philip Huscher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparola. Concerts by the CSO on Thursday, April 24th through Saturday, the 26th, feature one work, Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 3. The conductor for these performances will be incoming Zell Music Director Designate Klaus Mäkelä. The orchestra and Mäkelä will welcome contralto Wiebke Lehmkuhl, the Chicago Symphony Chorus, and Uniting Voices Chicago. Here are Philip Huscher's program notes on the Mahler Third Symphony, a work lasting about 92 minutes. Mahler spent the summer of 1893 in Steinbach on the Attersee near Salzburg. That year, he became a summer composer, establishing the pattern that would suit him the rest of his life, working on his music during the long summer days in the countryside, then returning to the hectic life of a conductor and the tiresome chores of administration during the season in the city. The next summer, Mahler had a tiny hut built precisely to his specifications on the edge of a giant meadow and right on the shore of the lake, where he could compose undisturbed. Years later, the man who built the cabin remembered that Mahler said he composed more easily when he could hear the water. He furnished it with a piano, a writing desk, a bookcase, and a wood-burning stove. From the windows, he could see only the lake and the mountains beyond. The hut is still there, but now located incongruously in the middle of a trailer park. Vacationers swim and play, suspicious of the occasional tourist intent on visiting the cabin where Mahler wrote his Third Symphony, the one inspired by the forces of nature he found in Steinbach, far from the noise of the city and the hubbub of society. Though Mahler enjoyed irony, it colors much of his music, he surely would not appreciate the shouts of children and the aromas of modern barbecue penetrating the room that became an almost sacred place for him during the summers of 1895 and 1896. He went there every day to write this symphony, beginning around 6:30 in the morning. Breakfast was brought to him on a tray. He was not to be disturbed unless the door to the hut was open. A scarecrow was put up in the meadow to discourage loud birds. Villagers were told to stay away. Nearby peasants bribed not to sharpen their scythes. He would break late each afternoon for lunch, a nap, reading, and a walk. For two summers, this music was his life. The history of this symphony is disorderly. Like most of Mahler's early symphonies, it took time and thought to reach its final, satisfying form. Movements were rearranged. The narrative program was refined, debated, and ultimately discarded. Titles were proposed, changed, and dropped. The music itself is wrapped up in the history of Mahler's other works of earlier songs and later symphonies, and of the ways all these compositions influenced and shaped one another. The genesis of Mahler's Third Symphony is so curious it sounds haphazard in the retelling. The first movement was added after the other movements were finished, and the original finale was removed and set aside only to turn up later as the last movement of Mahler's Fourth Symphony. The resulting work, with six movements divided into two large parts, is no more idiosyncratic than the way it evolved. Perhaps it is simplest to begin where Mahler began. The first music he sketched in the hut on the Attersee in June 1895 is the charming minuet that is now the symphony's second movement. It was, as Mahler recognized, the most carefree thing that I have ever written, as carefree as only flowers are. It all sways and waves in the air, like flowers bending on their stems in the wind. But, as Mahler later realized, when this one movement was performed on its own, it was the first music from the symphony ever played in public, and it gave people the wrong impression. It always strikes me as odd that most people, when they speak of nature, think only of flowers, little birds, and woodsy smells. No one knows the god Dionysus, the great Pan. Nature was Mahler's chosen subject, one that he absorbed daily in his mountain retreat, staring out the window as storms swept across the lake, or walking in the forest after a long day's work. He later wrote to the soprano, Anna von Mildenburg, "Just imagine a work of such magnitude that it actually mirrors the whole world. One is, so to speak, only an instrument played on by the universe. My symphony will be something the like of which the world has never yet heard. In it, the whole of nature finds a voice. In fact, when Bruno Walter went to visit Mahler and Steinbach the next summer and stopped to admire the mountain view, Mahler said, "No need to look. I have composed all this already." Mahler played through the score at the piano. His whole being seemed to breathe a mysterious affinity with the forces of nature, Walter wrote. I saw him as Pan. In the summer of 1895, Mahler's work evolved into a 7-movement symphony with a large-scale introductory movement before the flower minuet and the song Das himmlische Leben, Heavenly Life, composed in 1892 as the finale. By the end of the first summer's work, the symphony has a title, Die Friedliche Wissenschaft, The Joyful Science, taken from Friedrich Nietzsche's book of the same name. There is also a subtitle, A Summer Morning's Dream. Mahler lists 7 movements. Introduction, Pan Awakens, Summer Marches In, What the Flowers in the Meadow Tell Me, What the Animals of the Forest Tell Me, What Mankind Tells Me, Alto Solo, What the Angels Tell Me, Women's Chorus with Alto Solo, What Love Tells Me, and finally, Heavenly Life, Soprano Solo, Humorous. The sequence of the central movements over which Mahler had previously fussed now expressed the successive orders of being, as Mahler put it, flowers, animals, mankind, and angels. Of the movement addressed to love, Mahler wrote, I could almost call this movement What God Tells Me. The following summer, Mahler wrote the unexpectedly vast and complex opening movement, which depicts summer marching in and sweeping winter away. It sets the scene. Life emerges from inanimate matter. Mahler wrote to Natalie Boyle-Lechner, a violist and close friend, It has almost ceased to be music. It is hardly anything but sounds of nature. I could equally well have called the movement What the Mountains Tell Me. It's eerie, the way life gradually breaks through out of soulless, rigid matter. And as this life rises from stage to stage, it takes on ever more highly developed forms, flowers, beasts, man, up to the sphere of the spirits, the angels. Over the introduction to this movement, there lies again that atmosphere of brooding summer midday heat. Not a breath stirs. All life is suspended, and the sun-drenched air trembles and vibrates. At intervals, there comes the moans of youth, that is, captive life, struggling for release from the clutches of lifeless, rigid nature. At last, he breaks through and triumphs. But Mahler now realized that a child's vision of heavenly life was the wrong finale, even though it had served as the musical destination all along, with traces of its melodies and sounds embedded throughout the symphony. The great and spacious slow movement, What Love Tells Me, would stand at the end instead, unconventional as a finale perhaps, but music destined to be followed by nothing but silence. Ultimately, as with the first and second symphonies, Mahler decided audiences did not need to know any of the things that inspired this music, and he chose to delete the titles altogether. When the complete symphony was performed for the first time in 1902, it was simply listed as Symphony No. 3, and the movements were labeled only with plain tempo markings. Listeners could make of it what they wished. When Arnold Schoenberg attended the Vienna premiere in 1904, he wrote to Mahler, I think I have experienced your symphony. I felt the struggle for illusions. I felt the pain of one disillusioned. I saw the forces of evil and good contending. I saw a man in a torment of emotion exerting himself to gain inner harmony. I sensed a human being, a drama, truth, the most ruthless truth. We do not know how Mahler responded. We only know that for Schoenberg, the struggle within man was an issue worthy of such music, just as for Mahler, the subject was nature in its most complete form. The first movement is approximately one-third of the entire symphony. It is one of the largest single movements in all music and one of the most original and daring in the variety of music it includes. The opening theme for eight horns might well be a child's song. In the manuscript, Mahler calls it a Weckruf, a wake-up call. It's followed by a panoramic view of a great landscape. Pan awakens. Summer marches in from afar. The format is that of an introduction followed by a vast section in sonata form, but that familiar landscape is enriched almost beyond recognition by the scale and ingenuity of Mahler's plan, which weaves together chorales, military marches, a full-blown storm, a funeral march, and sounds from the distance, like the first glimmer of summer on the horizon. At half an hour in length, it is one of music's grandest and most overwhelming tapestries. The next four movements are relatively brief character pieces. The second movement, the graceful flower minuet, includes music that previews heavenly life, even though that song now belongs to Mahler's next symphony. There are two scherzo-like trios. The third movement, a kind of scherzo itself, is an orchestral version of Mahler's setting of Amlösung im Sommer, Relief in Summer, a song from Des Knaben Wunderhorn, the youth's magic horn, drawn from the beloved collection of German folk poetry published in the early 19th century that tells of the death of a cuckoo who is succeeded by the nightingale. Sounds of nature abound. The song, though unsung, is felt throughout the music. Cuckoo has collided with a green willow tree. Cuckoo is dead, he lies dead. Who should pass away the time for us all summer long? Ah, Mrs. Nightingale will do that. She sits on the green branch, that small and graceful nightingale, that lovely and sweet nightingale. She hops and sings. She's cheerful all the time when other birds are silent. We are waiting for Mrs. Nightingale. She lives in the green copse, and when the cuckoo's time is up, she'll start singing. There are two trios. The first, a vision of birds and beasts at play. The second, a still summer day disturbed only by the long, drawn-out call of the posthorn sounding from far off in the distance. It's played off stage. This is music of a very wide compass, the kind of challenge that demands a talent as enormous as Mahler's to pull off. The scherzo, the animal piece, Mahler wrote to Bauer Lechner, is the most ludicrous and, again, the most tragic there has ever been, just as only the music can mystically lead us from one to the other in a single turn. The movement ends with a great eruption of sound, as if Pan has arrived to transcend the world of birds and animals. The fourth movement introduces the sound of the human voice. This is a setting of the Midnight Song from Nietzsche's Also sprach Zarathustra, the source for Richard Strauss's grandiose tone poem composed the year Mahler finished this symphony. Mahler said his Midnight Song revealed the delicate nature of the human heart. Mahler marks the opening triple P. The music rarely rises above piano. It is as still and powerful as anything in music. The fifth movement, just 4 minutes long, follows without pause, jumping from the hush of midnight to the brightness of angels and morning bells. The text is drawn from Des Knaben Wunderhorn. The voices are those of women's chorus, children, and the alto soloist. The violins are silent throughout. Again, there are glimpses of heavenly life. This brief and rowdy episode full of laughing children and angels clears the air for Mahler's great hymn to eternal love. The final movement, Mahler's first great symphonic adagio, defies analysis. It is marked slow, calm, deeply felt. Mahler wrote atop his manuscript, "Father, regard my wounds, let no being be lost," a quotation from Des Knaben Wunderhorn. This is a grand song without words, for as the great conductor and Mahler champion Bruno Walter said of this movement, What language can utter heavenly love more powerfully and forcefully than music itself? A single, broadly unfolding paragraph of solemn yet intense expression slowly rises to an ecstatic conclusion. The dynamics reach up to triple F forte, but Mahler warns, not with raw force, with full, noble tone. The magnificence and sheer dumbfounding beauty of these pages answer and surmount all that has come before in this, the longest of Mahler's symphonies. Everything is resolved, Mahler said, in the calm of existence. The Adagio tells us in unforgettable ways how deep Mahler's understanding was, though he was only 36 years old, and how vast was his vision, even from the window of his tiny hut. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 3. I'm Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.